You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Oh, doing all right, all things considered.
I know that feeling. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Eric Levitz, senior correspondent at Vox. You've been with us once before on the podcast. A lot has happened since then. In fact, a lot has happened in only the last 7 weeks since Donald Trump was inaugurated. And I wanted to talk about that, try to take stock of that, and also talk about how the Democrats are reacting, what sort of long-term plan they may be developing, what kinds of arguments there are surrounding that. But just to start with the Trump stuff, do you have a way of like summarizing where we are in this?
Yeah, I don't know. It's there's, as you said, a tremendous amount has happened. I think that, you know, we've seen a few. I guess one way of focusing the conversation maybe is on what has surprised me, I guess, or at the very least, I think that there are a lot of things that have been happening more rapidly and to a more extreme extent than I had anticipated.
Velocity is definitely a feature of this administration. I would say high velocity, yes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is attributable to Elon Musk's entry into the government. Mm. I think that one of the saving graces, that I think there were a few, but of the first Trump administration was the fact that Donald Trump is not necessarily the most diligent individual in the world and is, I think, most enjoys some of the least consequential aspects of the role of president in terms of public relations and media stunts and whatnot. Whereas Elon Musk is, a manic workaholic, possibly drug-addled, but who is, actually very interested in implementing policy change and is used to the role of, used to running organizations where he enjoys sort of autocratic power as a CEO normally mm-hmm. would, and so does not have much tolerance for not being able to implement his vision on a really rapid time scale and pretty haphazardly. So I think that's changed the character of the administration somewhat. And then I think there's a separate thing where Trump is less constrained due to lacking, I think, some of the humility that he felt at the very beginning of the first administration, where he did seem a little bit overwhelmed by the job and more mm-hmm. prepared to defer to other people within the Republican apparatus, but also he fundamentally lacked a bench of people dedicated to what you could describe as his populist vision or as his personality cult. And I think also maybe felt a bit more constrained by the necessity of winning re-election. So I think all those things together have given us a much more radical first month plus yeah. than I had hoped for.
Yeah, there's been a lot of action, and certainly Musk has been a driver of some of it. I mean, I would say, in terms of your initial distinction between Musk being kind of focused and work-obsessed and Trump being more into media stunts, on the one hand, Musk also enjoys the occasional media stunt. In fact, I think only today he accused the senator of being a traitor. And Trump, for his part, it seems to me that some of the action is attributable to things other than Musk. I mean, for example, the tariffs, which have been pretty dramatic. And I guess one thing that I found a little encouraging over the past week is that it became evident that Trump is capable of receiving negative feedback and responding to it. He clearly got some negative feedback about Musk and kind of clipped his wings a little. And some of the power Musk had been exercising over firing was returned to cabinet. You know, secretaries where it had traditionally resided. And then on the tariff front, Trump did kind of pull back and reduce the tariffs toward Canada and Mexico, at least. I think maybe in that case, some of the negative feedback was coming from the stock market, and I don't know where else it may have been coming from. So there's that. Now, meanwhile, there's kind of a whole new front. Well, not new, really. I mean, but kind of what you could call threats to free speech, at least arguably threats to free speech. But those have come along a number of fronts. I mean, I saw a headline, actually, I think it was in Vox, about Trump is shredding the First Amendment. And I thought it was going to be a reference to them detaining and apparently planning to deport this Palestinian activist at Columbia. Or maybe to the $400 million they're withholding from Columbia kind of separately because it's not doing enough about anti-Semitism or something. But no, it turned out the article was about this thing I had completely forgotten about, which is that Trump is retaliating against these law firms by denying all their lawyers security clearance or something. So there's been, that's kind of a third front along which things are building. A lot of people seem particularly disturbed by this. Last thing, since this student did have a green card, and I have not yet heard much clarity about what he is said to have actually done wrong in terms of specific acts. They've said he's un-American, anti-Semitic, and pro-terrorist, but I haven't heard what he actually did. So I guess my first question would be, do you agree that there was a little, along those first two fronts, kind of Musk slash Doge and the tariff wars, there was some reduction in the momentum behind the chaos last week, which seems to be attributable to Trump getting negative feedback?
Yeah, I think that the exact significance of both steps back remains to be determined. But I do think that it does sort of make sense to me that there would be a period once Trump had put all of his cabinet secretaries in place that they would band together and recognize their mutual interest in exercising authority over their new fiefdoms and not liking Musk kind of haphazardly making unilateral decisions about their staffing that mm-hmm. also threatens to create, you know, really conspicuous failures of public services that will then be hung around their necks. So like I think it makes sense that that rebellion happened, and I think it's probably, you know, for the best that Trump was responsive to it. You know, to the exact extent to which Musk has been sidelined now is unclear. So we'll have to wait and see on that. I think on the tariffs, I'm of two minds. I think on the one hand, yeah, we have seen him climb down a bit, exempting a bunch of items from Canada and Mexico from his tariffs. You know, on the other hand, I think that maybe the we're still like, I think the conventional wisdom as of just like a couple weeks ago was that the Canada and Mexico 25% tariffs were never actually going to go into place. It was obviously just a negotiating ploy because it doesn't make any sense. And no one's asking for this in terms of really any interest group. There are interest groups that want tariffs on specific things, but no one was saying 25% across the board on Mexico and Canada. You know, we need to have Americans pay more for papayas. There's no real constituency for that. And so I think there's an extent to which we could maybe, you know, have Trump successfully work the Overton window in terms of there have been some walkbacks, but ultimately the place that we're still at is one where I believe it's now a 20% tariff across the board on Chinese goods, which if you didn't mm-hmm. have this other noise, that by itself is a pretty major policy. We have 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum, I believe, still going into effect tomorrow, I think. And we still have 25% tariffs on, I think, some Canadian and Mexican goods still, and the exemptions are officially framed, I believe, as just for a single month. And we had today, as we're talking, I believe that the Dow fell 900 to 1,000 points today, partly in response to the fact that the Trump pullback has not been as vigorous as I think many on Wall Street assumed that it would be. And Trump, even, you know, some of his advisors in interviews have been talking about how there's going to be a transition period and we need to grade this thing on the basis of years. And Trump refused to explicitly say that his policies were not going to cause a recession when prompted in a Fox interview. And so all this has Wall Street, I think, revising its sense of how serious Trump is about this protectionism stuff and how willing he is to endure immediate economic and political pain to realize his ideological goals. How resistant Trump is ultimately, again, we've seen some movement, so maybe if the stock pullback continues, then he will fully fold. But, you know, he hasn't yet. And at the beginning of April, he has another huge suite of new tariffs that he plans on implementing. So, yeah, I just think it remains to be seen exactly how much he is responding and is disciplined by financial markets.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have a theory as to what his kind of plan is on tariffs or whether there is one. I mean, you know, it's possible to make tariffs part of an industrial policy that's intended to protect certain industries that are capable of recovering or that are capable of being born and doing various things. But the tariffs would have to be much more surgical than these are. Now, I suppose it's possible that if, as you say, these are bargaining chips and he's going to surrender a considerable amount of the total kind of tariffs he's imposed, he could wind up with, you know, leave stuff in effect that does look surgical and strategic, I guess. But it's not clear to me that there's much sophisticated thinking going into this. I mean, and also, like, the question is, well, what does he want to really bargain about? What he's talking about with Mexico and Canada is mainly fentanyl, which I'm sure plays very well with parts of his base because there has been this epidemic of, you know, opioid overdose. But I can't believe that is actually what he considers the most valuable, you know, because first of all, that's just it's so hard to verify. And I mean, there's not that much coming over the Canadian border, you know, and I mean, the whole thing is hugely inflated. You know, the extent to which all three of these countries are kind of responsible for the fentanyl problem, including China, I mean. So I guess the questions are, like, is there behind all this some kind of intelligent industrial policy we'll eventually see that is going to be realized partly through tariffs, A, and B, like, if that's the case and the tariffs are going to, you know, slowly be withdrawn until we see the outlines of that, like, what does he want to get in the course of that bargaining process?
Yeah. I mean, my inclination is, you know, we can't know for sure, I guess, but as I was suggesting, the broad sweep of these tariffs is just so far outside anything that any protectionist policy wonk or industrial policy enthusiast has recommended or ever would recommend that it makes me skeptical that there is really a serious strategy behind it. So, I mean, we're putting large tariffs on agricultural products that cannot be physically grown at scale in the United States. There's no reason to do that. So I think that my gut is that Trump is what he sounds like, you know, that if you heard someone who had no particular experience in public policy and was kind of a blowhard 70-year-old crank who worked in real estate at a cocktail party ranting about how all these other countries are ripping us off, you know, if you gave him unilateral authority over American trade policy, you'd expect him to do things that don't necessarily make sense because they're just operating from an inaccurate and kind of cartoonish conception of the world. And I think that's partly what's going on. Part of it is also that, like, Trump's whole self-conception is as a great deal maker and negotiator, and he also is really has a passion for experiencing himself as, like, the dominant presence in a confrontation. And tariffs, you know, they don't necessarily succeed at anything else, but they do succeed at getting foreign leaders and major business industrialists to call him and come begging for, you know, some sort of concession or mercy. And that gives him the ability to make more deals, quote unquote, and feel himself powerful. There also is a corruption angle in terms of, if you put large tariffs, you know, this is something the president can do by himself, and then the president can unilaterally exempt different firms. And so it gives you, you know, some power to extract both official and perhaps unofficial concessions from different powerful interests. So I think that to the extent there is a rational strategy, I would suspect that, you know, it's more corrupt ones. I do think that there are people in Trump's firmament who are serious about industrial policy and are maybe, you know, at the margins influencing the exact shape of these things. Certainly there are people who think that the U.S. needs to, you know, manufacture more of its own goods. Certainly there's a lot of people on both parties who feel that our reliance on China for various commodities and goods is, you know, is a vulnerability in terms of national security. But it just doesn't seem to me that a trade policy that was designed around those concerns would not look like this one. In terms of what he's actually looking for from Canada and Mexico, I wrote a piece recently which was basically arguing that I'm not sure that he knows, because his rationalization for those tariffs changes so frequently. The official thing is fentanyl and migrants, is that Canada and Mexico aren't doing enough to secure their borders. I think part of that is because the specific authority that Trump did the tariffs under is an emergency economic powers authority. And so he needed to declare a national emergency, and the opioid crisis and migrant crisis functioned as those emergencies. So the more buttoned up members of the administration, I think, have tried to, for the purposes of making these things hold up in court, stick to the idea that this is just about fentanyl. But Trump is constantly contradicting that. Sometimes he's suggesting that we really don't need trade with Canada at all. They don't have anything that we require, and that we'll be better off and America will be wealthier if we're just relying on our own lumber and, you know, oil and manufacturing goods. Sometimes he suggests that really the idea here is to make Canada become the 51st state, to devastate them economically until they capitulate to his expansionist vision. So it's like,
do you think in his head he really thinks there's a chance that Canada is going to become part of the United States? I mean, some of these things, like, okay, intimidating Panama into doing something, and apparently, you know, a United States company did buy the company that was administering the ports, so now we own that. That's of no consequence, because the fact that a company in Hong Kong owned the ports, was administering the ports, had the contract to do that, was of no consequence to begin with. But that happened. And Greenland, I mean, I don't know, but Canada seems to me just the most obviously loopy, but he won't let it go. I mean, Greenland is loopy. That's crazy, yeah, too. But this is the most crazy, and he just won't shut up. Do you have a theory about, like, his brain?
I don't, because it seems so much like something that he would do just to humiliate the Canadian government, but also, mm-hmm, like something he could plausibly believe. All I know is that there have been reports in Canada that Justin Trudeau is at least told people that he is convinced that Trump genuinely believes this and genuinely wants to annex Canada, and that this is really what's motivating, in his policies. There was a report after a meeting he had with various industry leaders and trade unions where the other people in the meeting said that this is what Trudeau told them, that Trump in his conversations with Trudeau is just really emphasizing the statehood thing. So
because that's like clinical insanity, right? I mean, that's not, because it's just not going to happen. I mean, nobody in America wants it to happen. It's just, the funny thing is, I mean, the one thing he may accomplish is to sabotage the chances of the person who should be his ally, the closest thing to a Trumpist contender for the prime ministership, whose poll ratings have tanked as a consequence of Trump. And I mean, the thing he doesn't seem to understand, and this wouldn't take a lot of sophistication, is that when he says the kinds of things he said to Trudeau, there will be a rally around the flag effect. It will be good for Trudeau politically that Trump did this, A, and B, that political dynamic will incentivize Trudeau to tell him to go screw himself. You're not going to get capitulation because you're setting in motion a political incentive system that encourages the opposite. And he's also seeing that in Mexico. And I really think he doesn't anticipate these things. And it's not rocket science, right? It really is to him. It's like Trump, big man. Other people think they're big men. We'll show them. I mean, that really, I think, is about the extent of the thought. It's as much exasperation as there is about Trump, and much of which I think is actually misguided in the way it's expressed. And I do want to get to the subject of how the Democrats should react to this. Every once in a while I just think, I can't believe we're not all just freaking out. This is so crazy, especially when you throw in Musk, who's a certified nut these days. Yeah. I mean, this is like the one thing I think Musk is right about is we are living in a simulation. This is too crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there could be a rational economic calculation in terms of, like, it is true that Canada and Mexico are more dependent on trade with the United States than the United States is with Canada and Mexico. And this trade war is going to hurt those two countries much worse than it will hurt the United States, though it is going to leave everybody poorer. But, you know, the U.S. has the most coveted consumer market in the world. And so, like, I can understand on some level, I don't know that it's even this rational, but like on some level, Trump could just look at the, you know, raw might of the U.S. economy and feel that he should be able to dictate terms to Canada and Mexico because he can hurt them. But yeah, that would completely discount the idea that, you know, human beings are political animals. And
well, there would be a way to do that if that was goal. Like, don't say you're going to make them the 51st state. Don't say you're going to bomb Mexico. That would be the way to do it. Just use the tariffs themselves and be polite. But he's doing the opposite.
Yeah. No. And he's been the best thing that's happened to the liberals in Canada in a long time. I don't know. He doesn't have a good theory of mind and doesn't, you know, he's just not a very deliberate political actor.
And Musk doesn't either. And by the way, this is getting serious with Canada. You know, the new prime minister, the new liberal prime minister who will have to win an election soon, he's going to stay prime minister, but he became prime minister, I think, today or yesterday. I heard a clip where he's saying the Americans want to do X, Y, and Z to Canada. I mean, he's attributing it to all of us, which kind of surprised me. But I guess that means that plays. I mean, the degree of animosity Trump has stirred up, assuming this guy knows what he's doing, is such that demonizing all Americans now works in Canada, not just demonizing Trump or Republicans or Trumpists or anything.
Yeah, my friend and colleague, Zach Beauchamp, moved to Canada, Ontario, I think, from D.C. a couple years ago, and he's been saying that, you know, it's hard to convey how angry ordinary Canadians are about this and what a nationalist fervor there is right now and against the United States. So it's something I think that's maybe hard to appreciate fully on this side of the border, but like precisely because this does mean the U.S. president, for basically no reason, is single-handedly doing significant damage to Canadians' livelihoods and their economy, and that has been really mobilizing a lot of anti-American sentiment, and fortunately, because of the, you know, for the liberals, because of the rally around the flag effect, it's really like a liberal nationalist. Because the liberals are in power and because Donald Trump is a reactionary, it's feeding into a backlash that is both nationalist but liberal.
Yeah. Before we get into like what Democrats are talking about doing and what they should do and whether holding up those fans at the State of the Union address was an effective strategy, just quickly, you wrote a piece about Elon Musk that I haven't read, but I saw the headlines, intriguing. There's been some discussion of his dynamic with his father, but this piece is about his grandfather, right? What's the story there?
Yeah. So I think his grandfather's just a really fascinating character, and I want to be very clear and careful about it. I don't know what the intellectual genealogy exactly was, but I think he's an interesting figure, and I think that there are parallels between the worldview of his grandfather and Elon Musk that are interesting and unsettling. So Musk's grandfather, Joseph Haldeman, was a bit of a political seeker. He was a real eccentric. He was a really celebrated chiropractor, amateur pilot, and adventurer. But he also was involved in, you know, three distinct extremist political movements over the course of his life. The first was an organization called Technocracy Incorporated, which was a very odd offshoot of 1930s political radicalism, when it seemed like capitalism wasn't functioning and you had, you know, the rise of or advance of communism and fascism. And Technocracy Incorporated was this somewhat culty political movement run by this great engineer named Howard Scott, which argued that the fundamental problem with the global economy was the price system, and that capitalism no longer worked because technology had advanced so far and was so productive that it was reducing the monetary value of assets, which is why there was a depression. But also that the twin problem was representative democracy, which was a sham. And so what we really needed was for a group of really scientifically advanced technologists and engineers to run the North American economy according to scientific principles. And through this, they could establish something a little bit like a UBI, except they would give everybody energy certificates with a number of joules of energy they were allowed to consume each year, and prices would be replaced with these energy calculations. Anyway, it was very elaborate and eccentric. They also, all the core members, wore matching gray suits and saluted each other like they were soldiers, and drove around in gray cars that looked a little bit like the Cybertruck. And they referred to each other by number instead of name. Elon Musk has named one of his kids a kind of something very similar to like what technocrats would go by. So Haldeman was the head of the party in Canada. And he also resisted when the Canadian government tried to shut them down because they took a neutral stance on World War II, because they felt that British democracy was as much of a sham as Nazi fascism. Haldeman
was ultimately anti-democratic in some kind of like Curtis Yarvin way?
Yeah, basically. So I don't know. This is a long story, but boy, Haldeman goes from supporting this party. He joins another party called the Social Credit Party, which had a very similar technocratic view. It was a little bit more democratic. It felt that voters and politicians should be allowed to set the general parameters for policy, but those parameters would almost always be increase individual liberty and economic abundance. And then once they had established that, power to govern the economy should be fully concentrated in business leaders and experts within the government. And then they can be fired if they don't hit the targets. But fundamentally, you want to give the brilliant people the power to run the economy as they see fit, because they understand it better than voters. The Social Credit Party was also militantly anti-Semitic. It believed that one reason why you can't have regular democracy is the Jews control it. He got tired of the Social Credit Party eventually, and then realized that there was an actual, real existing utopian political movement, apartheid South Africa, that he could join. And he moved his family to South Africa, I think in the 1950s. I need to double check.
And wait, where had they been before that?
Canada.
In Canada.
Yeah.
Oh.
So they moved to South Africa specifically, seemingly because they were such enthusiasts of apartheid. And he also wrote multiple tracts about the global conspiracy against apartheid, in terms that sound somewhat reminiscent of the woke mind virus. He thought that there was global brainwashing to spread the lie that the Black population of South Africa was unhappy, and that Black South Africans recognized that the whites were, you know, the more advanced race and had brought this great technological progress to South Africa. So the argument I make is just that there's kind of a unifying core with all these different ideological views that this man adopted, which, you know, are that experts should run the government according to scientific principles, that democracy is hopelessly corrupt because of the conniving of Jewish financiers and the ignorance of the implicitly heavily non-white masses, and that the stakes of putting power in the hands of advanced experts or the advanced race, you know, are kind of apocalyptic, that basically if the right people are in power, we'll have economic utopia and abundance. And if not, you know, we're going to have the fall of civilization or total destruction. And then I just go through sort of Elon Musk's writings and comments over the past few years, and you see those same themes propping up again and again. So that's the idea of that piece.
Do you know if Musk had much interaction with his grandfather?
Yeah, so his grandfather, this is totally speculative. I just think it's interesting that the same kind of pattern of thought that these two men gravitated towards. I'm not claiming that it was necessarily genealogical. His grandfather died when he was 2 or 3, but he was close with his maternal grandmother. His father has said that his mother's family were huge supporters of apartheid and fans of Hitler. His father is somewhat a disreputable figure in and of himself, so I don't know if we should take his word. But Musk has spoken positively of his grandfather. So it's hard to say. Obviously, it's all, you know, I think that the strongest claim I'd venture is that this familial background maybe made him more open to taking this hard right turn later in life. But, you know, I mean, the guy was, as far as I understand, an Obama donor. I don't think that he was, you know, a hard right authoritarian until the last few years and was radicalized by the internet. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the way that Doge operates and the way that Musk talks about, or at least talked about, democracy before Trump won, which is repeatedly referring to George Soros orchestrating an invasion of illegals to steal the election and permanently doom America to socialist dictatorship, you know, there's lines in his grandfather's writing where he's talking about the same international conspiracy and Jewish financiers orchestrating an invasion of Africans from other surrounding countries to South Africa to overwhelm and end, you know, apartheid rule, that are just reminiscent. So, and I just think it's interesting, but I'm not going to make a hard claim that this is why Musk is the way he is.
Yeah. Now, his capacity, this isn't necessarily the same thing, but his capacity for embracing crackpot ideas and plainly dubious claims, like on social media and circulating them, is just stunning. I mean, what's stunning is that a guy who does that could also create these companies that make so much money. You would think you'd have to have a fundamental ability to discern truth and falsehood to like succeed at all in life. So it's just, you just, it's unclear what's going on. There are a lot of theories, you know. I mean, as for the turn left, apparently it was a big moment when Biden didn't invite him to the this EV summit thing. He was pissed off. I would have been pissed off too. I'm not sure I would have undergone quite the metamorphosis he's undergone since. But and then I saw somebody speculating, you know, his father, at only a few years younger than Musk is now, according to this person, they were quoting things, started acting kind of crazy. And this person was wondering whether it was something genetic, maybe, that showed up at a certain age. But who knows? But geez.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck by this chart from The Economist. I don't know if you've seen it, where they plotted out every tweet that Musk had sent along with the time of day, which just shows, like, after he bought Twitter, he's posting radically more often. But also, at least on first glance, it looks like there's a long period where, just through how often he's tweeting, you can see that he's sleeping at most like 4 hours a night, night after night, for like years. That, combined with Wall Street Journal's reporting on his drug use, like, I don't think it's implausible that we've seen just a deterioration in Musk's cognitive and mental health as a result of sleep deprivation and social media addiction and ketamine use or whatever else.
I mean, you can do scheduled tweets, although it may be that certain tweets that couldn't be the case with, and maybe they took that into account. And of course, there could be people tweeting for him, although I don't know. These don't look delegated. I wouldn't delegate that kind of power.
And it doesn't really make sense to schedule a tweet for 2 a.m.,
Let's see. Anything? Oh, I want to say one more thing about Musk before. I had this argument in the last podcast I taped with Danny Besner about whether we're kind of crossing the line from plutocracy to oligarchy, which I think we kind of are. There is a difference, right? Plutocracy is just rich people are disproportionately influential. That's been true maybe forever, certainly more and more lately in American politics. But with Musk in particular and Trump, I think we're seeing something new, and we're seeing more of it than in the first term. And I just wanted to, I won't go through the whole argument. I had these things that I said distinguish this from past episodes. But the thing I wish I had said, which I do think is new, is that the spectacle at the inauguration, where you had, you know, Sundar Pichai and all these guys who are running major companies show up at the inauguration, that's not new. What's new is that most of them would rather not have been seen there, right? Their lives would be simpler if they were not seen in Trump's company, because they have enough colleagues and friends and so on who hate Trump that they would just rather not do it. But they showed up. And if you ask them, well, what kind of power must a president be exercising to make that happen? You know, the answer is more of an oligarchy kind of power, where they know that he will just single you out. You better contribute $1 million to his inaugural ball fund, which they all did dutifully. And you better show up at the inauguration and pay your respects, or he will punish you personally. I don't know. I mean, you could. There are other data points I cited, but I won't rehash those, because I already do too much repetition of myself. Inflict too much of that on regular listeners of the podcast. But do you have a take on the oligarchy thing before we go on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there was a time maybe in Trump's first term where I had more you know, patience for or interest in the idea that, you know, we're overemphasizing what a break Trump is from past precedent, especially in the Republican Party or generally. But now I think that that's a kind of corrosive perspective, because I just think that, like, yes, every capitalist democracy is, you know, going to be a political system in which the wealthy have more influence than the typical person does. But there is just, you know, liberal democracy was still a major advance towards egalitarian rule compared to what came before it and what, you know, passes for democracy or governance in Russia or, you know, these other more autocratic countries. And it's just, I don't think that garden variety influence peddling and the president of the United States, you know, have maintaining a meme coin in which you can directly deposit cash into his bank account, where he's firing all law enforcement officials who participated in any way in prosecuting people who committed political violence in his name.
Apparently they plan to fire a bunch of FBI agents. Oh, I don't know what the status of this is, but who just, they're out in the Phoenix office or something. And somebody says, go look into this. And they do. These people were not like agents in that sense. They were just FBI agents doing their job.
Followed orders. Yeah. You know, it's different when you have, you know, and Mar-a-Lago is charging these like exorbitant rates for people to have, I think, FaceTime with the president, or at least entry to the resort. You know, it's just, it's really in your face, aggressive influence peddling, obviously giving Elon Musk the kind of direct power that he has had over the federal government after having him be your top patron. You know, I think it's something else. And the contempt for law that his Justice Department appointees have shown, the DC Attorney General, who just openly refers to himself as the president's lawyer, who sent that letter to Elon Musk, where he says explicitly that his office will investigate people, even if they have, just for acting unethically, not violating the law, but just the whom they deem have acted unethically, they will chase them to the ends of the earth to bring them to justice. You know, this is new and different, and I don't think it's useful to suggest that it's just more of the same or a more open form of the garden variety American corruption.
Okay, so the time has come for us to go into overtime. That's a part of the conversation that's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Easy to become one. There's a link in the show notes. Or you can go to Non-Zero at Substack and or Google those two. The Substack's not, the URL is nonzero.org. Set up your special podcast feed. We obviously encourage this kind of support, but I also want to thank people who are not going to follow us into overtime for listening this far. In overtime, I want to, for one thing, continue in a way. I mean, you had said that in the first Trump term, you thought there was some tendency to overemphasize how sharp a break he represented. I sometimes felt that way too. And in any event, I felt that people were sometimes, well, reacting to Trump in a counterproductive way. And I still feel that. I still feel there was some of that that in a way has makes his life easier now. But in any event, I want to talk in overtime about the whole conversation about what Democrats should and shouldn't do, whether how they handled the State of the Union made sense, what their message should be next time around, what Gavin Newsom is up to with the trans issue and stuff like that. And then I also want to talk about this, the free speech issue, and in particular, the detaining of this Columbia student. So thanks to everybody who's stayed with us this far. And now we are heading into overtime.